Good evening, welcome behind the news for July 10, 2003, after that full rendition of the theme by the Kronos Quartet. And my name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, an interview recorded the other day with George Monbiot, author of a new book called Without Our Consent. I forgot to bring me the book. I'll identify it during the interview, but don't have the title right at hand. George Monbiot is a columnist for the Guardian newspaper, and anybody who frequents the Internet has probably seen his stuff circulating around. He has some ideas on how to restructure the system of global economic and political governance, and a somewhat perhaps controversial position on globalization in general and the WTO in particular. And we'll hear that in a few minutes. And then in about half an hour, we'll talk with the journalist and activist Marta Russell, who was recently in New York for a UN conference on the rights of the disabled. And she's going to be talking about what happened at that conference and what the U.S. position has been and such. But before we get to George Monbiot, a little bit of the economic news, as I've been tracking for the last couple of weeks, actually a couple of months, is the state of the U.S. economic recovery, which there was a great deal of optimism about in the moments right after the war ended. Well, the war didn't really end, and the economy didn't really recover either. So we've sort of stumbling along, but there's really been no significant post-war bounce in the economy, just as there's been no end to the violence in Iraq after the alleged end of the war there. This morning's release of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that is, people who have just lost their jobs and are visiting unemployment offices for the first time looking to get benefits. That's a very reliable weekly indicator of what's happening with the job market, and that's not good. This morning's report of last week's numbers rose by 5,000, and the report of the estimate for the week before was revised upwards, and number of people continuing to draw jobless benefits, that is, people who have been collecting benefits for weeks and are continuing to do so, which is also a measure of the state of the labor, good contemporary measure of the state of the labor market, that also rose to 3.8 million, a high for this cycle, and actually the highest number of people drawing unemployment benefits in over 20 years. And that's a little misleading comparison because the labor market and the population are much larger than they were 20 years ago. But still, the level of people continuing to draw unemployment checks is quite high. And what this suggests is that employers are still cutting costs by laying people off and also being very, very, very slow to hire new employees. There were some signs that they were maybe extending work weeks and hiring temp workers, but there's been little in the way of hiring for new permanent jobs, and people are continuing to lose jobs. So this is not the kind of thing you want to see if you're looking for signs of an economic recovery in the United States. Also, the Mortgage Bankers Association puts out a weekly index of demand for mortgages. There are several components to the index, and the two interesting ones are the number of people who are applying for mortgages to buy a house, but also the number of people who are refinancing their existing mortgages. And the refinancings have been very important lately because with interest rates at generation lows, a lot of people have been exchanging their old high-interest mortgages for a much lower-interest mortgage. But of great economic interest is that many people, when they do that, have been taking some cash out of the house, that is, borrowing against the alleged appreciation in the value of the house and getting some ready cash out of that and spending it. Spending of cash-out refi, as it's called in the business, spending of the proceeds of cash-out refis has been one of the main props to consumer demand in the U.S. economy over the last months, actually the last couple of years, even as the job market has remained very weak and people's personal incomes have not been very strong. At least they've been able to borrow against the appreciated value of their houses. And these numbers had been very, very strong, and now they seem to have rolled over and they're heading downwards. So one source of strength in the economy is showing signs of weakening. This is interesting for several reasons. First of all, Alan Greenspan has been telling us there has been no housing bubble in the United States. He had told us throughout the 90s that there was no stock market bubble, so his record on bubble diagnosis is not stunning. But he has told us that the rise in housing, house prices, and the continuing increase in mortgages and mortgage demand, this is not a bubble, just normal, nothing to worry about, said Greenspan. So we shall see. The time when things get interesting is when a trend reverses. That is, that's when things get dangerous. We can see if there has been a bubble. So if these numbers are any indication, the boom in the housing market has come to an end, and we're going to see now if it was indeed a bubble or just some normal exuberance. And we'll see if Greenspan was right about this one, even if he is wrong about the stock market. Now, for people who are looking for an economic recovery in the United States, in normal business cycles, a couple of things that really kick things, help the economy get off the mat and kick things into a higher gear, and those are generally housing and automobile demand. These are both very sensitive to interest rates, sensitive to people's long-term moods, and people's confidence in the economy. And they never really declined in this recession very much. There's been, indeed, the housing market was very, very strong. Demand for autos remained pretty strong. And now both these things have been weakening. But it's kind of hard to imagine where you can get an economic recovery from if these two normal contributors to recovery have been strong and now are weakening. So we shall see. This has not been a textbook economic cycle. And this is another aspect of its departure from familiar paradigms. And finally, the one of the reasons that employers have been very slow to hire and the businesses have been very slow to expand their investment spending is that their profit margins have been quite low. And actually, the profit rate for U.S. corporations rose steadily from the early 80s into about 1997 and then collapsed and took a very, very deep deep fall. And one of the things, of course, that kept the financial markets happy and kept the economy expanding in the 80s and 90s was that profit rates were high and rising. And one of the things that brought the boom and the bubble to an end was a decline in profit rates starting in 1997. They've begun to recover a little bit in the last couple of months. Or a year or so, but they still have a very, very long way to go. And even though this recession that we've been living through for the last couple of years has been rather mild by conventional measures, by most measures, unemployment rate hasn't risen anywhere near as high as it usually does. Incomes haven't fallen nearly as badly as they usually do. This is one area where there has been a severe recession in the profit rate. And if you're a devotee of that old Marx fellow, you think that the profit rate is the motor of capitalist economies, and that motor has been sputtering. And one of the things that that businesses have been trying to do to get that profit rate back up is holding back on investments and holding back on hiring. And profit margins still remain quite thin, and until they can get those profit rates rising, we're not going to see much of economic recovery. So, bottom line, things are not looking so bright in the U.S. economy, despite a great deal of optimism around. So we shall see. And now, an interview I recorded earlier this week with George Monbiot, a British economic journalist, columnist for The Guardian newspaper, and author of a new book, Without Our Consent, I believe it's called. You'll hear it during the interview what the title is. And it's only out in Britain right now, and it will be out in the United States late this year or early next, coming out from the New Press. But I thought that what he had to say was rather interesting. I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but some caller some months back asked me to do more programming on what is to be done kinds of questions, how we can make this a better world, and I'm listening. And so here's an installment on that enterprise. George Monbiot, interview recorded earlier this week.
Welcome to WBAI, George Monbiot. You've got a piece that's circulating the internet widely that essentially is a mea culpa, that you were wrong about globalization and the WTO, and these sorts of confessions are pretty rare in the punditry game. So could you tell us how you came to this change of heart, and what evolution in your thinking has occurred?
Yes, well, some time ago, I believe that we had to get rid of the World Trade Organization because I felt that so many of its decisions were oppressive and were deeply damaging to the poor world, and I still feel that. I'm still aware that it's been used as an instrument by the rich world for extremely unfair and undemocratic decision making. But it's become plain to me that the only thing worse than a world world with the wrong trade institutions is a world with no trade institutions at all, in which it's basically just crudely controlled by the rich world, which uses the absence of rules for piracy and plunder. And it seems to me that there's a desperate need not to get rid of the World Trade Organization, but to turn it upside down, to turn it into a fair trade organization, to ensure that the rules it makes are the rules which permit poor nations to develop in the way they want to develop, and at the same time forces corporations trading between nations to trade fairly, rather than just always to force countries down to the lowest common denominator.
I want to return to your idea of a fair trade organization a little later, but a lot of folks have talked about reforming the World Bank, the IMF. You are an abolitionist. You don't think they're reformable organizations. Why do you think that is?
The principal problem with them both is that they put the entire burden of discharging debt and discharging trade deficits onto the debtor nations and the deficit nations, and these, of course, are the nations least able to affect the balance of trade and least able to affect the global credit situation. They were imposed in 1944 over and above a solution which was considered almost universally to be a much better one, and this was for a system designed by John Maynard Keynes called the International Clearing Union, which was for an international bank in which all countries held their trade accounts, and countries were given a very powerful incentive to get rid of all the money, either the deficit or the surplus in their accounts, by the end of the year, because they were charged interest both on their debts in the trade accounts but also on their credit accounts. If you had $100 million in your international trade account, by the end of the year you'd only have 95 or 90 because you'd be charged interest. And so what he created was an incentive for the nations in trade surplus to reinvest into the nations in trade deficit, so that you ended up without any long-term accumulation of trading debts, which then turn into international debt. And so he had a sort of self-balancing, self-clearing system which put an equal onus on the debtor nations and the creditor nations to make sure that the balance of trade was actually sorted out worldwide. That idea was scrapped in favour of the World Bank and the IMF through brute force, really, extreme pressure applied, I'm afraid to say, by the US through the negotiations at Bretton Woods. And the result was that we've ended up with a grotesquely unfair system which perpetually punishes the poor nations.
Some people, especially with the Bush regime running things, have talked about reinvigorating or reforming the UN as an approach to better global governance. You're skeptical about the UN. Could you talk a bit about your critique of that organization?
Well, I certainly don't want to get rid of the UN altogether, but I certainly do want to get rid of the UN Security Council. I think it's grotesquely unfair that five nations should have power over all the other countries on Earth, that any one of those five can veto a proposal approved by all the other 190 members of the United Nations. I would scrap the Security Council and vest its powers in the General Assembly, but then I would democratize the General Assembly as well. The problem is that even without the Security Council, it's still an undemocratic organization, because the countries which aren't democracies have the same voting power as the countries which are democracies, even though they have no claim to represent their people at all. And it's absolutely riddled with rotten boroughs. You've got the 10,000 people of Tuvalu have the same vote as the 1 billion people of India, which means that every Tuvaluan is worth 100,000 Indians. And that is extremely unfair, and it creates a very powerful incentive for the rich nations, the powerful nations, to try to bribe and blackmail the small ones in order to buy their votes. So what I would suggest is weighted voting. Voting weighted according to both the size of the country's population and its degree of democratization, that the higher up it comes on a global democracy index, then the higher the score, the higher the vote it would get within the UN.
A lot of folks in the global justice movement have talked about relocalization. They're very skeptical about trade or even hostile to it. You dissent from this point of view. Could you talk about your critique of localism?
Yes. I used to be a localizer, and I've really changed my tune on this one. The problem is that the the rich nations can localize. They are in a position, if they so wish, to follow a route to self-reliance in manufacturing, where they'd only have to import raw materials. The poor nations are not in the same position. In most poor nations, there is simply not sufficient domestic demand to make manufacturing for the local market worthwhile of complex goods. I mean, Ethiopia, if it tried to manufacture its own computers, every single one would cost tens of thousands of dollars. It would just be completely uneconomic to do. The result would be that while the only products required by the rich world of the poor world were raw materials, the poor world would continue to have to import high-value manufacturers from the rich world. So what you would see is that the poor world's position would continue to deteriorate. They'd be forced into a trade in raw materials, and yet they'd be forced to continue to buy expensive imports. And so it just makes no sense at all when you look at it in that light.
And also a lot of people in the global justice movement talk about reinvigorating the power of nation-states. You are also skeptical about that, and talk about making an end run about around nations. What's wrong with the return to the nation state as our focus of activity?
I'm not hostile to the nation state, but it's very clear to me that the issues which we as a movement are most interested in, such as debt and climate change and the balance of trade between nations and nuclear proliferation and war, those issues can only be resolved at the global level. We can't resolve them just within the nation state and just at the local level. There has to be some form of global governance. So what I'm saying is it's not a choice between having no global governance and the global governance that I'm proposing. It's a choice between having the undemocratic global governance we have today and the democratic global governance which I'm calling for. I'm talking about democratizing the governance which already exists at the global level. We can't turn our back on globalization. In fact, it's an opportunity. Our task should not be to overthrow globalization, but to capture it and to use it as a vehicle for humanity's first global democratic revolution.
Most of the international institutions we have now are organizations of nation states. You've got ideas about, for example, a world parliament, which is really answerable to the world's people and not to its nations. This is a very ambitious plan, and I'm not going to fault you for making an ambitious proposal, but could you talk a little bit about your idea of a global parliament?
Sure. I envisage a parliament built from the bottom up, not handed down by the existing powers as a sort of sop to the masses, but built by the masses, by the people, by the citizens of the world, as their institution in which they elect their representatives basically whose primary function would be to hold to account the other international powers, to say to them, we are the only people who can claim to represent the citizens of the world. As such, we have the moral authority to say to you other people, the financial institutions, the trade institutions, the United Nations, here are our principles of good global governance. You're offending these principles. How do you account for them? And so it's a sort of accountability mechanism for global governance. And I feel that without that, global governance would still be undemocratic in many ways.
Now, this would be a parliament without an army?
Yes, it's a parliament, indeed, without even a rule-making capacity, certainly to begin with. It's not a legislature. It doesn't sit down and make rules and try and enforce them. At least in the early stages, its sole role is to hold these other bodies to account. But I could envisage in the future that it begins to take on some of the powers which are currently vested with undemocratic bodies at the global level. And maybe in time you could see the World Parliament and the reformulated UN General Assembly coming together to form a two-chambered, a bicameral parliament for the planet. And then possibly you could see powers being transferred from the indirectly elected body, the UN, towards the directly elected body, the World Parliament.
This sounds a little bit like the European Parliament, which is not a very powerful institution at the moment, though it may become one. What in general do you think of the European Union as a model of regional political integration?
I think part of the problem with the European Union is that the democracy that exists within it is very much a democracy which has been granted to us by our lords and masters. They've let us have a little bit of democracy on their terms. It's not one which has been built up from below. And as a result, we in Europe really have very little sense of public ownership of the European Parliament or indeed of any of the European institutions. And I think that's a lesson which we can learn when we're looking at the world scale, that if we're going to have democratic institutions globally, they've got to be built from the bottom up. They've got to be slowly constructed by the world's people with very clear endpoints in mind. So saying, what we see at the European level is that if the European Parliament wasn't there, Europe would be far worse than it is at present. It would be run entirely by bureaucrats and entirely by the remote and delegated powers of the nation states, who very seldom consult their people at all before making a decision at that level. So at least with the European Parliament, we have a direct handle on power, and we have a moderating force which affects the European Commission and the European Council. At the global level, of course, we have no such thing, and that's why we need a world parliament.
I'm speaking with George Monbiot, author of The Age of Consent, A Manifesto for a New World Order. Along with the World Parliament, you've got a couple of other global institutions in mind. You alluded to two of them, the International Clearing Union and the Fair Trade Organization. Could you talk first about what you have in mind with this International Clearing Union?
Yes. I've dug up the old idea that John Maynard Keynes devised. He spent 13 years working on this between 1931 and 1944. And it was this idea of a self-balancing mechanism, and it's an automatic correction to trade deficits and trade surpluses. It's this international bank in which the nations which participate hold their trade accounts in a neutral currency. Keynes called it the Bancor. They accumulate their trade surpluses or their trade deficits in Bancors, and by the end of the year, if they don't have zero in their account, in other words, if they haven't cleared their deficit or cleared their surplus, they get charged on that account. And the money they get charged goes into a reserve fund, which will amount to several tens of billions of dollars a year, a very useful source of money for some of our other international projects. So in order not to pay too much into that reserve fund, the countries in surplus will do everything possible to productively reinvest their money rather than just seeing it being drained away. And of course, in aggregate, that means that the surplus nations reinvest into the deficit nations, and so you get a balance of trade re-established, and you don't get these wild swings, this boom and bust of the global economy which we have at the moment. It's a much, much better system than the one involving the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
And now a fair trade organization, what might that look like?
Well, in terms of structure, it wouldn't be too different to the World Trade Organization, except it would be a lot more open and transparent and accountable, and there wouldn't be these secret committees of corporate lawyers, and there wouldn't be these so-called green room meetings in which a few select countries make all the decisions before the others can get their eyes on them. But it would be a gathering of nation states which set trade rules. Those rules would be very different to the ones we've got today. They would be rules which were designed to benefit the poor nations and to redistribute wealth worldwide. And so the poor nations would be permitted to do what all the rich nations did during their key development phases. The key thing there is what's called infant industry protection. It's a term which was coined by Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the US Treasury, and was very, very effective in allowing the United States to develop. You basically protect your small infant industries until they're big enough to fight on the global stage. And indeed, the US was the most heavily protected nation on Earth up till 1913, and as a result, it was also the fastest growing. It did extremely well during that whole period, and it was only after it had already achieved its international dominance that it suddenly discovered the virtues of free trade. And the same, exactly the same, can be said of Great Britain, that we were a very, very heavily protected nation until the 1850s, when again we'd already achieved dominance, and so suddenly free trade was a good thing. Now, what's being forced on the poor nations today is direct and immediate, fully fledged competition from the word go, with huge corporations which already have all the advantages on their side. They have capital, they have expertise, they have intellectual property rights, they have established marketing networks, and they can just crush these infant industries as they're developing. So poor nations must be permitted to defend their industries, while rich nations should not be permitted to do so. And what we could see is a sliding scale, that as a nation developed, it would begin to lose some of its privileges.
Well, a lot of people in the global justice movement, also in organized labor in the United States, for example, are advocates of protection. They're afraid of people in low-wage countries stealing our jobs. What's your reaction to that kind of complaint?
I think that that's a reactionary and regressive approach. I think that that is exactly what could not be better designed to alienate the poor world and to split this movement. It's absolutely essential that in order to have a redistribution of wealth, the poor world must have access to the rich world's markets, and it must have preferential access. It must have better access to the rich world's markets than the rich world has to the poor world's markets. Now, of course, that means pain in the rich world, but it doesn't mean pain if we are prepared politically to take on the people who have concentrated our own economies in their own hands. At the moment, we have a situation in both Britain and the United States and most of the other rich nations in which there's an incredibly skewed distribution of wealth. There's very profound inequality. There's enough money in these nations for everybody. There's enough money for full employment, there's enough money for a vigorous economy, but not if it's all secreted in the hands of the ultra-rich, which it tends to be in both the United States and in Britain. So we will suffer, but only if we're not prepared to take on that historic responsibility we have, which is to demand the distribution of wealth at home. But to try to get by continuing to exploit other nations, or exploiting them even more crudely, as some of this new protectionism suggests, is simply not the way through. Our success should not rely on the exploitation of other people around the world who are in a far more vulnerable position than we are in.
A lot of people in the global justice movement are also anti-corporate. You know, people like David Corton, who talk about corporations as usurpers, and what we need to do is get back to an Adam Smithian world of smaller enterprises, maybe partnerships or proprietorships. They're not always very clear on this, but they're anti-corporate. There's something wrong about the corporate form. You don't have much to say about this, but I'm curious what your thinking is on this, this issue.
Well, I do talk about this. I feel that it's essential that we rein in the corporations with an extremely tight regulatory framework at the international level. So the other function of the Fair Trade Organization would be to become an international licensing authority. It says to the corporations, you may trade internationally, but only if you fit these extremely stringent regulations which we're going to lay down for you. So you have to first demonstrate that you're not using slaves in your cocoa plantations. You're not using banned pesticides. You're not having your workers having their arms ripped off in your factories or being exposed to asbestos. You demonstrate these things, then you can trade internationally. We grant you a license to trade. You don't demonstrate them, we remove that license until you can sort yourselves out. And that means that only the ethical corporations can then trade internationally, and all corporations are forced then to become ethical. They're forced to pay their workers properly, they're forced to respect the environment, and most importantly, they would be forced to pay the full costs that they exert on society. So instead of being able to dump all their pollution in the river, they're forced to pay not to create that pollution in the first place. If in these costs we incorporate the costs of fossil fuel use, the costs on the climate of using fossil fuel, then what we very rapidly see is two things. First of all, it becomes ridiculous to try and shift very large volumes of high volume, low value goods all around the world, as happens at the moment. Secondly, the countries which are currently sources of raw materials, most of which are in the poor world, then become the most favoured locations for manufacturing, because it costs a lot less to ship a load of aluminium saucepans around the world than to ship the bauxite from which they were made. And so that then contributes to the distribution of wealth at the same time as protecting the environment.
Well, I was also referring to that there's some issues of scale and scope, the nature of ownership. That is that people like Corton object to corporations that can do business across large expanses of space, but also exist having charters with no expiration date, and with you know, complicated ownership structures, dispersed and often distant shareholders. They're looking for something smaller and more intimate. Do you have any feelings on that specific issue?
Well, I'd certainly agree that we have to rein them in with much tighter charters and expiration dates. We have to do something very urgently about limited liability and about their devolution of responsibility onto subsidiaries from which they then withdraw all their funds, so that they ensure that the workers get no compensation when they've been injured and the rest of it. Yes, we have to deal very strictly with corporations. If the question is, does that then mean there are no international corporations? The answer is no, in my book. That I see corporations as probably being necessary to permit trade to take place between nations, but they have to be very, very strictly regulated. Now, what we find in the fair trade movement, the voluntary fair trade movement, which already exists, is that the corporations who are often best able to discharge all the stringent fair trade conditions are the small and medium-sized ones, because they can do the sort of micromanagement which is necessary to ensure that they're trading fairly. So there is an inbuilt advantage here for small and medium-sized corporations.
And finally, how to get from here to there. Certainly existing nation states and existing private power structures are going to object to most of your manifesto. I think you're hoping for an international popular movement that would be the force behind the agenda. But how do you deal with opposition coming from governments and private power, and also, in particular, almost certain powerful objection of the United States, which doesn't even like a world court, much less a
sure.
world parliament?
Well, in a curious way, your president has become our biggest ally, because he is destroying many of the institutions which are themselves grotesquely unjust and were actually devised to sustain the power of the U.S. government at the global level. He seems determined to destroy the Security Council. He's undermining the World Trade Organization as it currently exists. He's undermining the World Bank and the IMF. In doing so, he presents the rest of the world with a very stark choice. He's effectively saying to other powerful nations, either you sit back and watch while we govern directly from Washington and cut you out of any foothold in global power, or you better do something about it. And already the other nations are having to do something about it. They've been doing it with the International Criminal Court, with the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. Now Bush has effectively challenged them to do something about the international security system, and people are already looking at that. And that puts us, citizens, into potentially a powerful situation. Jonathan Schell has pointed out that there are two global superpowers now. There's the U.S. government and there's world public opinion. If the other nations want to challenge the U.S., the only way they're going to do so is by recruiting the second global superpower, us, against the first one, Bush. And that means that we then have power in which we can press our demands. But there's another mechanism as well, which has been remarkably little explored, and this is the extremely powerful weapon which the poor nations possess, and this weapon is their debt. We often hear that if you owe the bank $1,000, you're in trouble, and if you owe the bank $1,000,000, the bank is in trouble. So what if you owe the bank $2.5 trillion, which is the size of the third world's debt? In other words, you own the global financial system, and if the poor nations were to gang up and threaten a mass collective default, that would concentrate the minds of the US and the other powers to a great extent. That would effectively force them to start taking the demands of the poor world much more seriously.
All right, that's a good way to end. Thank you for joining us, George Monbiot.
Thanks very much indeed.
And that was George Monbiot, the British economic journalist, author of the book The Age of Consent, A Manifesto for a New World Order. That's only published in a British edition right now. Flamingo is the publisher. You can get it if you're really enterprising. By going to amazon.uk, or you can wait for the new press to publish a U.S. edition in about a year or so. Actually, a little less than a year, probably late this year, early next. And I noticed in the acknowledgments to the book that George Monbiot had thanked Brian Eno, and I was very curious about Brian Eno, the musician, originally with Roxy Music in the early 70s, and then had a long solo career ever since. And I was sort of curious about what that was all about, and so I asked him what the contribution of Brian Eno was, and here's his answer.
He's a brilliant political thinker. There are only two in Britain, really, him and Tom York, who are both great musicians and great thinkers. And he's been quite influential in my thinking, and we've had some interesting talks. Just had a message from him yesterday, actually, saying that he's just read the book and he's really into it and would like to see where we can take it now.
And who knew that about Brian Eno? But here's a bit. Well, I should say, before we play this little bit of Brian Eno, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And now this little classic snippet from mid-70s, Brian Eno, Babies on Fire.
Babies on Fire. Throw her in the water. Look at her laughing like a heifer to the slaughter. Baby's on fire, and all the laughing boys are pinching, waiting for photos. Oh, the plot is so bewitching. Rescue us, change the subject. Blow the wind, blow. Lay some assistance to the object. Photographers, snip, snap. Take your time, she's only burning. This kind of experience is necessary for her.
Brian Eno, an excerpt from his mid-70s song, Babies on Fire. And we learned from George Monbiot, one of the great political thinkers in England today. Going to pursue that further and find out what great thoughts he has. And now we're joined by Marta Russell, who is author of book Beyond Ramps. We had her on a couple of years ago now, I think, discussing that as an analysis of the theory of disability and what it means in a capitalist society. She's a frequent contributor to the ZNet commentaries. And welcome to WBAI, Marta.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's been too long since you were on the show.
Yeah, well, here I am.
Well, you were in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I thought I got to meet you after all these years of electronic correspondence. But what brought you here? Tell us about what event at the UN brought you to New York City for an extended visit.
Well, actually, the American Association of People with Disabilities sent me to attend a meeting. It was the second ad hoc committee meeting of the United Nations on a comprehensive and integral international convention to promote and protect the rights and dignity of persons with disabilities. I gave you the long title because that's how the UN does it.
Yes, they're not shy about using words.
No.
Now, I was surprised to learn when I talked to you that there's very little in the existing human rights literature or declarations about people with disabilities. So this is really a first for the UN, right?
Well, there are some clauses in former law where disabled persons have been included. But traditionally, human rights have been applied to disabled persons as objects of rehabilitation and prevention, not as subjects considered fully human with comprehensive rights of citizenship. So the social model, which is inherent in the non-discrimination approach, emphasizes that its institutions, such as political, economic, social, cultural organizations of society that impose, quote, disability upon those who have impairments by segregating and excluding us from the rights others enjoy. So this is the next step that we're trying to achieve, moving beyond the rehabilitation and prevention medical model to an inclusion model.
So, and as far as I understand the UN process, they have conferences about conferences about conferences. So this is one step in a process that's going to extend over a couple of years. So can you describe the process that this is part of?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, it's taken years and years since the 1970s to move up to a discussion of discrimination and disability. This was the second ad hoc committee meeting. The first was in Quito, Ecuador, in April of this year. And the General Assembly had charged this ad hoc committee to decide whether the UN would give a green light to a disability thematic human rights treaty. So there were a couple of issues on the table, number one being whether we would proceed with a human rights treaty that is disability specific, and secondly, how the work would proceed.
So how is the work proceeding?
Well, we did pretty good. I'd have to say we established ourselves on the working group to draft a convention, and then in UN speak, a convention is a treaty. So we have 12 persons that will be placed on that working group that will be appointed by DPOs, Disabled People's Organizations. And then there will be 27 member states, and they will be charged with coming up with a draft or a couple of drafts that will then lead to an adoption of a draft to be discussed and negotiated by all the member states again. And that's set for some time next year in June, I believe.
And speaking of member states, what is our government up to?
Well, as you can imagine, the Bush administration continues to set itself apart from world opinion. It was right out front with its position. On the third day, Ralph Boyd, who is the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, came to the meeting, the plenary, and said that a global treaty on disability and human rights was not necessary. Instead, he said the country should follow the U.S. model and adopt non-discrimination laws. And he said he, the United States, would help to craft such model laws, but, quote, not with the expectation that we will become party to any resulting legal instrument, close quote. And as you can imagine, that was not what we had hoped for. However, it wasn't the worst thing that could have happened, which would have been obstruction, complete obstruction. So they didn't choose to actively support the convention, but neither did they obstruct it. And they, in these kind of proceedings, ad hoc committees, decision is arrived at by consensus. So if there's any member state that completely objects, they can halt the process dead in its tracks. But nonetheless, the United States International Council on Disabilities was quite upset with the White House and wrote them a pretty stinging letter, which I would like to quote from here. They wrote that the development of Human Rights Convention on Disability is a historic and critical step towards ensuring that the rights of people with disabilities are viewed by societies and governments as human rights, not just low priority component of domestic policy. And close quote, that low priority is especially significant given what's happened in the United States with the ADA.
Yeah, let's talk about the ADA a bit. I know you're no fan of it, but it was perceived as a milestone of sorts at the time. What's wrong with the approach of the ADA and its implementation?
Well, it hasn't been the ADA itself. It's been the courts have pretty much been systematically dismantling it. So the administration seems to have some perception that the U.S. has seamlessly integrated disabled people into American society, but that really belies our reality. We've been watching for many years now that this business-friendly Supreme Court shrank the legal definition of disability to accommodate employers instead of employees with disabilities. 92% to 95% of disabled plaintiffs lose their employment discrimination cases in U.S. courts. Deserving Americans who seek redress in court face summary judgments instead of getting to a trial by jury. States have challenged their obligations to comply with the law. There's been no systematic plan to make America accessible. Instead, what we've had is like an individual-by-individual cases brought before the courts, and usually the cases are subverted by these decisions when they reach the higher court, which we know is very conservative. And changes in the environment usually aren't made unless someone forces the issue. There's a case right now going before the Supreme Court where a paraplegic in Tennessee is challenging the ruling there that he has no right to sue the state because the courthouse was inaccessible to him and he was required to be in court and had to climb up a flight of stairs, get out of his wheelchair and climb up a flight of stairs. And it seems the state of Tennessee did not agree to hold that court session in an accessible location, so he sued. That the justices will be hearing that one. But really, you know, the ADA was set up that way. If there's no access, the only thing that is an option for people is to sue. And so now they're saying, the state is saying disabled citizens don't have the right to sue them.
So that essentially puts all the burden on the people with disabilities and nothing on employers or governments to make society accommodating.
Well, exactly.
And this is what the Bush administration thinks of as a model for the world to emulate.
Yes, gallingly, that's what it thinks.
Well, what do the other people at this conference think, and what's your sense of the other countries' positions on this issue?
Well, I felt there was a tremendous amount of support for moving forward. The other member states were recognizing that there are issues here that haven't been addressed in any of the other international treaties. They're saying that, you know, within their own countries, that the situation needs improvement for disabled persons. And there was over 100 member states there attending this ad hoc committee, which in and of itself shows that there was a great deal of interest, along with 42 non-governmental organizations, the so-called civil society, composed of disability groups and their allies. So there was a huge turnout.
Now, you can say that these UN things, conferences and declarations, are just really an expression of good intentions and don't have much effect. What is this process? What kind of effect would this process have, and a document that might emerge from it? Is it just a matter of drawing attention to a problem, or would it have more legal force than that?
No, it would be a legally binding treaty, and that's what's missing at this point. Of course, we know that even with legally binding treaties, that each nation then must agree to sign on or ratify that particular treaty. So it will depend on a nation's cooperation even after it's adopted by the United Nations. And so the outcome is at this point very unclear. The important thing is that we need to be working towards consensus building to get to the next step, which is to even pass the treaty into law so that then the member states can each take it back to their countries and have the discussion within their own nations. it might be helpful for me to just point out a few ways that rights might be tailored to disability.
Please do.
There's 28 rights in the UN's Declaration of Human Rights, and they're quite comprehensive, actually. If you looked at it from a disability perspective, to be free from torture and cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment or punishment, including violent and harmful medical practices, would include events such as putting developmentally disabled persons in cages or performing involuntary psychiatric procedures, the right to personal integrity, freedom from degrading, dehumanizing treatment could also include not to be institutionalized or abused by caregivers, the right to marry and have a family sounds so simple, but that's often out of reach for disabled people in many parts of the world, to be free from forced sterilization, the right to access the justice system. This is where the ADA does serve as a model, such as to grant sign language interpreters in the court, and the right to life, and as this I mean, as opposed to being chained in a public square and starved to death. I was recently sent a picture by fellow activists in the UK of a 4-year-old girl who had been stripped naked, and she had a rope tied around her neck. It was a picture appeared on the front page of the Daily Mirror in the UK last year. The heading was "Hung Out to Die," and the rope was tied to a column, and the little girl's back was up against a hard corner at the base of her spine. And 3 days after this picture was taken, the child was dead. Her community in a remote Indian village said she was possessed by evil spirits, but her real crime was that she was developmentally disabled. Article 25 of the Declaration of Human Rights says that, quote, motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. All children, whether born in or out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. Well, this little girl had no protection. She was starved to death in the public space of that village.
Well, and so, but we can assume that the Bush administration is not going to be doing anything to push this process along, or if it should get to the point, they would not ratify it as a treaty, I assume.
Well, I doubt it. It's going to be a big, huge job for us here in this country to push them to do so, but auto-rejection of international law has a long history in the U.S. I think the U.S. has ratified only 3 of 26 international human rights treaties, and it's failed to ratify the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. It failed to ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It failed to ratify the Convention on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers, for instance. Those are 3 specific populations just right there. And this is a long history, going back to the 1950s. I believe it's tied into states' rights and this internal feud over whether individuals in this country would be able to invoke treaty provisions in the U.S. courts. And so we've just not been a part of the international community for as far as human rights treaties are concerned.
All right. I'm afraid we're out of time, but good luck with the fight. And I must say a lot of activists on the left have not paid close enough attention to these kinds of issues, but
Do
a bit to remedy that here.
Well, I thank you for that, and I hope people will find out more and do what they can along the way.
All right. Well, we'll keep up with this. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you, Doug.
Marta Russell. Marta Russell is the author of the book Beyond Ramps, published by Common Courage Press, and a frequent contributor to the ZNet commentaries. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with this little bit from Wilma Briney now.
Drifting as the hours go slowly by. it's that time again. It's time for the WBAI staff, volunteers, and of course you, the listeners, to come.